On the Empire Podcast this week, we check in with Wes Anderson at the Grand Budapest Hotel, and then, in true TripAdvisor style, bitch and moan about the curtains. And did you miss him? Did you miss him? Did you miss him? Did you miss him? Sherlock's Andrew Scott drops by to talk about his new movie, The Stag. All that and more on the movie podcast, but quite miss BBC Three, actually. Leave it alone. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. After last week's live show to celebrate our centenary, we're back in the studio and ready to embark on, hopefully, another 100 or so of these things.
Oh, God.
It's a good thing.
Yes, of course.
Helping us get along a winding road are three of my most esteemed and foolhardy colleagues. First, our geek queen, who's a massive fan of Supernatural, so imagine her disappointment when she watched Winchester 73 and found out it wasn't an Abtastic prequel, but a Jimmy Stewart Western. It's Helen O'Hara!
Right, okay, I would never be disappointed by Jimmy Stewart. He's wonderful. And there are really hardly any abs in Supernatural.
There must be abs.
Barely.
To be fair,
any
I've
abs.
Never seen Supernatural.
No.
Next up is a man who's widely hailed as our art house guru, but he's keen to stress he's into more commercial fare too. After all, his favourite superhero is Bergman. It's Phil Dissemblian. Hello,
hi,
Phil.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'd like to extend an apology to Aki Kaurismäki. For our
every podcast should start this way.
For our just in general, yeah. For not appreciating his work at enough depth, but also for our live podcast quiz where we had to try and spell his name and no one got close.
For those who don't know what Phil's talking about, last week at the live show, we gave out spot prizes. We asked people questions in order to win prizes. One of the questions was a sort of spelling bee to spell Aki Kaurismäki's name.
Yes.
How do you spell it, Phil?
I don't know.
Adeem Nazam.
Adeem Nazam. The wickedly talented, one and only
K-A-U-R-I-S-M-A-K-I.
Okay, fair enough.
Aki Putang Zopurimpi.
All right, now we've got that nonsense out of the way. Last but not least is our tech whiz, a man who's never happier than when he's editing this podcast on at least four separate laptops, Rick Wakeman style. It's Ali Plum.
I'm glad BBC Three is gone.
Why are you glad BBC Three is gone? It hasn't gone, it's just gone away. It's shunted to the iPlayer.
It's in a farm upstate, yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I enjoyed Family Guy the first time I watched it. And then.
Yeah, but they're responsible for so much great comedy.
Go on.
I was hoping you wouldn't pick, but not. The comedy shows are on BBC Three.
I remember. No, I don't remember.
You must remember the comedy shows are on BBC Three.
BBC Four still exists.
Yes, BBC Four still exists.
It hasn't moved down.
That's the arts-minded BBC station. Yes, with lots of documentaries. Whereas BBC Three is like, yeah, Lager and Crisps.
Yeah, Magaluf. They did have documentaries.
Actually, you talked me around. I'm glad BBC Three is gone. Screw it. All right, so let's take your questions. You've been sending them in all week via the twits. The first one is from @AturT, who asks, what's the first film you walked out of? Mine was The Crow 2. It was bad enough, then Iggy Pop started masturbating.
What an amazing coincidence that he was in the cinema with
I know.
How did that...
Well, he does have a lust for life. Okay, first film you walked out of.
I've never walked out of a film.
You've never walked out of a film?
No, you've paid... however much, mm-hmm. no matter how rubbish it is, mm-hmm. you stick it through to the end so you can bitch about the curtains later.
Do you? You do.
Okay.
I haven't walked out of a film either. I may have sat through some real drag. What was that Lenny Henry film where he whites up?
A True Identity.
Yeah. I sat through the whole of that.
You sat through,
if you can sit through the whole of that, you can sit through the whole of anything, including 2010 A Space Odyssey 2. Uh-huh. Conquest of Paradise I also sat through.
Uh-huh.
I have been walked out of a film. Been marched out, but I think I might have.
Was it Iggy Pop cocking
all of this?
You're coming with me.
You gotta give us some context there.
Yeah,
you can't just introduce that. Go on. What were you marched out of?
I went to watch in a crowded West End cinema, a packed West End cinema, See No Evil, Hear No Evil with my dad.
That's a blinder.
Which is not the greatest in the prior world of canon.
It's not,
but you know, it had its moments. But my dad doesn't particularly approve of the cursing elements of movies.
Okay.
And he never really has. So we, about a third of the way through this movie, and bear in mind that we were sitting sort of halfway down, right on the other end of the aisle, so you had to go past everyone to get out. Mm-hmm. Dad turned to me and he just went, "Next time there's a swear word, we're going." So I spent the next however long just praying that they weren't going to swear.
Why did you say that tone of voice? You didn't write the script.
Is that...
Why did he say that?
I don't know. It wasn't my fault. Exactly. But he was just like, I'm not going to. And I think he felt bad that he'd taken me to this and he'd have to go home and explain to mum how his impressionable son had absorbed all this Richard Pryor cursing. Anyway, so there's a bit where, I don't know if you're familiar with the film, but there's a bit where Pryor and Wilder are cornered by the villainess and she turns to them and says, "Do you have any last requests?" And Richard Pryor thinks for a minute. And I'm thinking for a minute, don't say what you're about to say. And he thinks a bit more and then he goes, "I suppose a fuck would be out of the question." And dad just grabs me and we're gone. But we're gone in slow past all these people out the...
Did he try to eject other people as well? Right, you're coming too.
Everyone's coming.
You, let's go. I've got a bus.
Pop, you're coming. Yeah.
Well, how did your dad feel about the scene where Gene Wilder pretends to be an FBI agent and he holds a lady hostage and she's naked? He doesn't hold her hostage, but he pretends to have her at gunpoint and he puts his fingers in his pocket to pretend he has a gun. Mm-hmm. And then because she's naked at the end of the scene, the punchline is he takes his hand away from his pocket, but the bulge remains because...
Of course, he's seen everything.
Tumescent because, yeah.
Thank you
loved
explaining.
All that. Yeah, I wanted to do so in a tasteful manner.
You know who the last person to use the word tumescent was? You.
Cop.
You. About a year ago. Yeah.
I'm worth a million of prizes. Also, I'm tumescent.
Amazing. Mr. You're the only person in the world that uses that word. I love it.
It appeared in 10 Things I Hate About You.
I love
course.
The idea that on Iggy Pop's front door, there's a little letter that goes, I Pop.
Massive tumescence. Well, my dad doesn't have a problem with that sort of visual-based tumescence gag. He's okay with that completely. Maybe because he was weaned on the whole carry-on oeuvre.
Did he not have any prior knowledge?
But, oh, God. This is getting wilder and wilder.
Hey.
Sorry, Dad. Anyway, Mum and Dad went to watch 12 Years a Slave on Monday, and that was much
from
more...
From the sublime to the ridiculous.
Much more to her taste. Helen.
Mine's much more shameful. I walked out of Leaving Las Vegas. It was a free screening. It was at university. And it was just... I was just not in the mood. Nobody I was with was in the mood. We were all just looking at each other going, this is so depressing.
So you were leaving Las Vegas?
We left Leaving Las Vegas. Yeah. I thought at one point I'd also have to leave Chasing Amy because I went to see that in uni as well with a friend of mine who was, you know, quite straight-laced. He's a lot less straight-laced nowadays, but he was very, very straight-laced those days. When they started having quite graphic discussions of, you know, what Amy... Well, not what Amy, but what she did with her girlfriend... You know, he got visibly uncomfortable and I was sort of sitting there going, he's going to walk out any second now. And
what did Iggy Pop think of it?
Iggy Pop seemed to be okay with it.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Iggy popped out, I think.
We can't walk out of films, though, because we're professionals.
We don't now. We don't now.
Apart from Pacific Rim.
Do you think of the...
You snored out of Pacific Rim.
I don't know how I slept through that film.
You did walk out of Pacific Rim. You say you haven't walked out of a film. You walked out of that one.
It's like falling asleep on an airport runway. It's just, I don't know. And I did leave. But that's been tackled before in this very podcast.
It certainly has.
I would like to apologise to all concerned in the making of that film.
For the repetition of an anecdote. Next question is from Hector LG, who asks, what would you prefer to sit through? 10 one-hour Michael Bay films or one 10-hour M. Night Shyamalan film? There's a twist.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if it was Shyamalan on form, if we could, you know, if we could be assured that it would be... You know, the guy who brought us The Sixth Sense or even Signs.
I think that guy's gone, Helen.
Yeah.
He's gone. Say goodbye to him.
You know, I like him. He's a nice guy. We had him in here for After Earth, and even though the film isn't all that, you know, he explained it very well, and I saw what he was going for, and I kind of appreciated that. 10 one-hour Michael Bay films. I mean, how would you even cope with the explosions after
that? I honestly don't think there's a debate here.
I think it's Michael Bay all the
it's
way.
Michael Bay.
There have been 10 Michael Bay movies. His 11th is just coming up. So are we taking 10 Michael Bay films, excluding Age of Extinction, and compressing them to an hour? Because if that's the case, if we took the hour's worth of great stuff in each film, or good stuff in each film, then we're rolling.
Oh,
then
hang
I'm
on.
Happy.
I'm on board. Okay, good. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
Even that aside, I would rather watch, as bad as Michael Bay's Transformers movies have mostly been, the first one, I still think, aside... I'd rather watch a Michael Bay film because at least it has a bit of energy and a bit of gusto and you know, explosions and funny one-liners. And I'm not sure about that. I love Unbreakable. I love The Sixth Sense. But honestly, his most recent films have been turgid self-parodies.
Mm. I will say there's a 10-minute supercut online of every transformation in the Transformers movies, which is utterly brilliant. I mean, I think that's possibly more down to ILM than Michael Bay, but it's just terrific. So if it was just kind of that for 10 hours, I'd probably be happy.
I think I'd watch... a 10-hour cut of The Rock.
Yes, me too. One other thing is that his movies do, for the most part, star the wickedly talented Shia LaBeouf, and we love him.
Wickedly talented one and only Shubby the Bibbaloob. Okay, I think we've definitively answered that one. Let's move on.
I'd like to watch 10 Michael Bay Samsung product launches.
Phil, would you rather sit through one 10-hour Ingmar Bergman film?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
10 10-hour Ingmar
Bergman films? God, good question. Can I have both?
Why not?
11
because you've been good. Why not? Alright, next question is from at Wood of Kings. By the way, that was not an endorsement necessarily of Michael Bay over M. Night Shyamalan, in case anyone's getting the niggers in the twist, but we answered the question put before us.
We did.
Right? We
yes.
did. Okay. At Wood of Kings, great name, asks, as running times increase, maybe it's time we brought intermissions back. My bladder would be grateful.
First of all, train your bladder. Come on.
How to train your bladder.
How to train
coming
your
next summer.
Bladder. It's, I mean, you don't want to turn into... there's a certain member of the Empire team who always has to sit on the edge of the row so he can get up and go to the toilet halfway through the film.
I think we should refrain from naming Dan
Jolin.
The Hobbit has two intermissions and they're each a year long.
Boom.
Sing, burn.
Take that, Bilbo Baggins.
Lakeside. Lake Town.
What do we think about this? The last film I actually saw that had an intermission was Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, which had it in at the 2-hour mark, and it was gratefully accepted. we walked around and thought about things for a while, and then we went back in and enjoyed it even more. I suggested to Adam McKay that the new longer cut of Anchorman, which is now out of cinemas already, just lasted for a week, and I quite enjoyed it, actually.
Okay.
Quite enjoyed it, but it is 2.5 hours long. Should have had an intermission, but not just normal intermission. Should have had a really depressing intermission, so you would be showing pictures of like puppies being punched and stuff, just to, you know, really get you down again, and then the comedy starts. He thought it was a good idea, but it was too late, Adam.
Wow.
Too late.
Just him, then.
Maybe not the puppies being punched, but, you know, sad things, like, you know, EastEnders.
Do you not be surprised to see them re-release this film with that idea in it in the next few weeks.
It was. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. There was a couple of things in there that they definitely shouldn't have cut out the original version, I thought.
Like?
There was a cracking musical number, which McKay said that it ground the narrative to a halt, but really there is no narrative. So that argument's a bit moot, but it's really, really funny. And there's some nice alternate takes I thought were better than the original as well. But there's lots of jokes. I started writing them down on my phone. Looked like a weird stalker halfway through, I'm sure. Anyway, yes. Anyone else on intermissions?
Is this talking about Wolf of Wall Street? Because I'm curious to see, I know it's not going to happen, but part of me would love a Blu-ray version of Wolf of Wall Street to be the quintine-hour cut that Scorsese originally had planned, which was whittled down to just over 3. Mm. Presumably that's what we're talking about here. Because I think if, you know, what else did they get up to? I mean, what else, what other debauchery was to be seen? I'm very curious.
Yeah, I'd be very intrigued to see that. But it is a good point. You know, a lot of films are 2.5, 3 hours. Some of, you know, obviously there have been great films throughout history. Lawrence of Arabia is nearly 4 hours long. Do they need intermissions? You don't go to the theatre and sit through 4 hours necessarily, do you, Helen?
If it's 4 hours, there's generally an intermission. If it's you know, 2, 2.5, not necessarily. Usually, if it's 2.5, but honestly, I think if it's under 3, there's no way there should be an intermission. Mm-hmm. If it's approaching 4, maybe there's a case for it. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, you know, just
go and
immerse yourself.
I think cinemas
want to get people in and out, don't they, as much as they can.
Yeah, but think about it. If you went to see a 3-hour film, a 3 to 3.5 hour film, and you had a 15-minute intermission, and then you had Jeff Stelling and Chris Kamara talk about the film you'd just seen and analyse the highlights. But during that time, if you didn't want to watch that, you could nip out the foyer and buy yourself a big mega gulp and some popcorn.
Look at the blocking here.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Absolutely. I can imagine. We circle them here as he delivers that line. You talk about pace, power, precision. That'd be great. How good would that be? That'd be amazing. Anyway, I fear we've lost everyone. Let's move on to the next question. This is a good one from at Andrew A. Moore, who says, best forgotten Oscar winners / nominees. I fear for Barkhat Abdi, great as he is.
Yeah, I hope he gets some really good roles in the near future. I think he could do great things. He was fantastic in that film. He worked really hard at it and, you know, deserves some more big shots. The names that came to mind after some thinking in this instance, Keisha Castle Hughes. Remember her?
Keisha Castle Hughes.
Yeah.
Yes, she was in Well Rider.
Yes.
And then she went on to star in
Revenge of the Sith.
She was in Revenge of the Sith briefly. She was also in The Nativity.
Yes.
Where she played Mary, and I remember the story because she actually got knocked up off the set as well. So she was, you know, that kind of ground her career to a halt.
Method.
Yeah. She went full method.
Jay Davidson, Oscar nominated obviously for The Crying Game, and he wasn't particularly keen on becoming an actor in the first place, so I suppose it's a slightly different thing, but I think he'd been chased by Neil Jordan's casting director and persuaded eventually to take the role. Got Oscar nominated, was a big sensation overnight, and then I just disappeared again into obscurity. I don't think he ever really hankered for a career.
Choice. It was his choice.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't really hanker for a career as an actor particularly, so he didn't get an agent, didn't bother with any of that stuff.
But first he was in Stargate. So there's that.
He was raw. So yeah, in a sense, already as powerful as he was ever going to be. And
that's a great one-two punch to anyone's CV, isn't it?
Hell yeah.
The Crying Game and Stargate. I'd walk away after that.
I like Stargate.
You can see Damien Bashir. Do you remember Damien Bashir, who was Oscar nominated for A Better Life, which was directed by, help me out, Helen.
I forget.
Me too. Damien Bashir, who starred in A Better Life, was Oscar nominated. He has subsequently been cast as the evil Mexican in like 5 different Hollywood films. So you can see why sometimes it can be a bit frustrating for people to get immediately typecast as the villain of whatever sort of ethical background they have, ethnic background they have.
Jean Dujardin, of course, made fun of that in a Funny or Die video straight after his Oscar nomination for The Artist, you know, arguing that now, of course, he'd be cast in every villain role in every sequel in Hollywood, which is a very, very funny clip. He hasn't obviously gone that route. But as a result, he's had quite small Hollywood roles. So, you know, maybe there's something to be said for taking the villain roles where, if that's what you're offered.
I'd like to mention Jack Wilde from Oliver. Got a Best Supporting Actor nod. And he died reasonably recently. But then there's also Dean Stockwell, who I know isn't, like, forgotten by any means, but he is my favourite. Of course, played Al in Quantum Leap and was also in Battlestar Galactica. But he was nominated in 1988 for Married to the Mob. You know, you're still a big fan of his from his TV work. But, oh, he got an Oscar nomination. Oh, good for him. Danny
Aiello.
Let me hear you say...
Danny Aiello.
There we go. Who was in Hudson Hawk, which we all love. But, yeah, he got nominated for playing the Sal, the pizzeria owner, in Do the Right Thing, where he's excellent. He's excellent in everything, including Hudson Hawk. But he is somebody I feel like is underloved and... though I can't pronounce his name properly.
They all yeah. I mean, those guys, most people we mentioned have sort of gone on to get steady work, albeit in, you know, supporting type roles. There's news recently that Barker Babdi's struggling to find work and to, you know, to make ends meet, because obviously he shot Captain Phillips a couple of years ago, and since then it's been he's not had a lot of acting work come through on the back of it. But there is news that he may be joining a film called Place That Hits the Sun, apparently, in which he'll play a South African marathon runner.
Cool.
Who ran in the 1992 New York Marathon, I believe. So, fingers crossed for him.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely, indeed. Keisha Castle-Hughes update. She's married to a DJ called Jonathan Morrison, and she moved in 2013 to LA to pursue a bigger acting career. We wish her all the best. Okay, if you want to get in touch with us on the Empire Podcast, you can Facebook us, we're Empire Magazine. You can Twitter us, we're at Empire Magazine. Please use the hashtag Empire Podcast. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first interview. Andrew Scott is the Irish actor who hit the big time as a nefarious nemesis of Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock Holmes, and whose recent return to the show set tongues wagging furiously. This week, he can be seen as a lead in Irish stag do comedy, The Stag, and in the interests of colliding Irish accents together so they became so thick that subtitles would be required, we sent Helen along to interview him earlier this week, so we did. Helen, did you enjoy it?
Oh yes, he's a lovely man, so he is. He's just rehearsing a play in London. So
lovely fella. Enjoy the interview.
Andrew Scott, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you.
So The Stag is the story of a stag do gone wrong or right? It's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, well, you go through the foothills of the of wrong and right, I think, just like you do in the foothills of the mountains. There's a nice little analogy there for you.
Very lovely. Yeah.
yeah, it is. The basic subject matter of it is you know, why we go on stags, really, and it's about kind of very modern modern Irish males. And about modern friendship, really, and whether the idea of a stag is outdated and all that kind of stuff. So this, I suppose, the premise of the film is to ask the question, is, you know, what's the point of stags in this day and age when we're all allowed to have female and male friends and all that kind of stuff.
It's not really a goodbye to anything at this point in in a man's life anymore, right?
No, exactly. You're not going to be like, oh, it's your last day of freedom. And the ball and chain and all those horrendous things. Yeah. Or even for hen nights, actually, as well. You know.
And you've done a lot of audio work as well. And I was interested to see that you voiced Jay Gatsby.
Yes, I did. I sure did.
Did you feel a bit aggrieved that Leo got the film role then?
I couldn't believe it. I was in shock, Alan. Do you know what? That is such an incredibly beautiful... I had never read the book before I did the radio. And it's an incredibly... Actually, quite a cinematic character, which is why, weirdly, it works on radio. But, yeah, I've done a lot of work on the radio. You can be very... you can be actually very expressive on the radio just using your voice.
Yeah.
And something the voice is something that I am very interested in, sort of using the different, what's the word, timbres of your voice? Timbres of your voice, and you know how we use and how all our voices change on a day-to-day basis, you know.
And did you go around calling people old sport?
Old sport. Yeah, I did. That's what's great. It's so romantic. It'll break your heart, that book.
Wow.
It's a real piece of genius, isn't it? No, it was extraordinary. Yeah, it was really... really amazing to do that.
I mean, you've done other audiobooks and that kind of thing as well. Are you a big reader yourself, or is it just what you know?
No, I just read it. I just read. I've read four books, and I've done four radio plays. No, I do. I do like reading. It's kind of one of the things where you have to read a lot of scripts for your job. It can sometimes take the joy out of it. You get a bit word blind. Yeah, I mean, for example, the radio play, I had read the book, but I didn't want to read the book too much. A little bit like the research thing. If it's adapted from a book, I always kind of don't want to read the book, which some people say is madness. But I don't know. I feel like then you have information that you have, and you've got to be in charge of the storytelling that the script is doing. It's an interesting one, that, you know.
And I know you like doing accents. Do you have a favourite? How's the one you're doing? No, you're doing one at the moment for this play.
I'm doing
sort
of what they call estuary.
Estuary, how's that?
Which is sort of an English accent, but isn't too specific. But I do, I love accents. I do. I'm not sure, you know, you have different abilities with different dialects. But I do like it. I do like it. But then sometimes it's good not to do any accent as well.
Yeah.
You know.
Esther English recently. You've also been doing posh recently, I think, for Frankenstein. Is this correct?
Yes. Yeah. But a little bit of posh.
A little bit of posh. I'm not sure that's a geographical location.
RP, as they call it. Sort of more standard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's actually easier. It's actually easier. I think maybe we hear it a little bit more, or maybe easier for an Irish for an Irish accent. It's really, we were just talking about it there in rehearsals. I'm rehearsing a play at the moment, and we were just talking about when people say do a little bit of an accent is actually much more difficult than kind of going the whole hog. And so, you know, there's this kind of accent they call, which is mid-Atlantic, where they say, you put on a mid-Atlantic accent. You think, what the hell is that? How do I do that? Which I think just means don't colour it too much.
I've got some questions I've been given by colleagues.
Oh, yeah.
About Sherlock,
sure.
In particular, of course.
And Sherlock, sorry, just remind me.
It's quite popular. We TV
okay,
series.
Okay. Oh, yes, I do. Yes. I remember.
First of all, though, I've got to ask, you know, as an Irish person, how do you feel about Benedict Cumberbatch photobombing U2 at the Oscars?
I thought it was absolutely glorious. It made me, like, incandescently happy. I thought it was so brilliant. Photobombing is always brilliant.
Yes.
But it was so brilliant. It was just so fantastic.
It was very athletic photobombing.
Well, he got right up there, didn't he? I love him for it, and I will love him forever. I think it's my favourite thing he's ever done.
Wow.
Offset.
Of course.
Yeah.
Now, if his fans are Cumberbitches, what should we call yours?
Well, that's a controversial question. They have two names. One of them is Scotties, and the other is Mascots.
Oh.
Mm, so,
oh, those are both good.
Yeah, they're both good.
Yeah.
Which what are you feeling, Ellen?
Well, I quite like Mascots. Just
Yeah, I like Mascots too, but then I don't want to come down and each to his own.
We don't want to cause a flame war somewhere between two rival groups.
Exactly,
of fandom.
Exactly, like West Side Story. How bizarre would that be?
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
And no, when people come up to you in the street and shout, did you miss me? Do you have a standard response?
People are so sweet, really, really, about that. People go, actually, we really did. You go, oh, thank you. So they answer for themselves. I haven't had a huge amount of that, really. I get a lot of it in mail, in fan mail.
So what did you do for the did you miss me scene? Did you go into a studio for a day? Did you, you know... Do you remember how that was shot?
I remember it really clearly. I'd just been locked up in a straitjacket for the day. I only did one day's filming on Sherlock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was quite bizarre because I was filming the Ken Loach movie at the time, and I came back to do this the crazy thing in the lunatic asylum. With Benedict, and then later on that day, we just did loads of different ways.
Okay.
Which is the kind of way I like to work anyway, which is to just do lots of embarrassing stuff and lots of kind of more respectful, slightly attempting to be cool stuff that always never works. And then you just give it over to them. I did it lots of different ways. Did it without saying it. Did it trying to do it in a look. And then they choose whatever they choose.
So was that the same day that you also did the kissing scene then on the
No, rooftop? Oh, sorry, no, I'm sorry. We did that a separate day.
Okay, fine. Because I was also asked specific questions about that.
Oh, I'm sure you were. Come on, perverts.
Well, no, but basically that, I mean, you know, how many takes, like what, you know, what was involved?
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to remember last year. So
it's a long time ago.
We went back up to the roof of St. Bart's, and no, we did it quite quickly. We were quite giggly during it, as you can imagine. It's a very funny premise, we did about three takes, I think. Yeah,
and you, at least the scene was written, so you could, you know, look happy and not be sort of, you know.
Yeah, it was sort of they were out of character. They were kind of out of character. Yeah,
intentionally.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly.
It was probably one. I mean, did you get like a lot of texts when that stuff airs? You know.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. You do. You get a lot of. I mean, it's extraordinary to be in that show because everybody has a relationship with it, whether they hate it or whether they don't like it. They certainly know about it, but most people get very excited by it. And and also because I have always keep a secret as to what's involved, so people
are
thank you. So people are always aghast that I haven't told them.
Right.
You know, my close friends and family and pets.
So it's just the phone just buzzing and buzzing and
yeah,
buzzing.
Yeah, the phone does a bit of buzzing. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Also, you're a voice in Locke.
Yeah.
I'm about to see that this evening.
Oh, good. You'll enjoy it. He's fantastic. Tom is absolutely extraordinary.
I hear great things, but Ruth Wilson was apparently describing this hotel room she was in for recording as just the most horrible room.
Oh, it was like fluorescent, horrible. Like dodgy hotel on the side of, I shouldn't name the hotel, but it was like one of those, you know, very corporate. I actually remember I'd just come back from LA, so I was quite jet lagged, and I'd finished filming. And the great thing about doing an audio thing is that it doesn't matter what you eat. So, and I was jet lagged, so I keep associating that with jelly tots. That's all I just ate, just like massive sugar buzz. Then go in, do the take. So the character is quite. High octane. I don't know if that was in the script or was it based on my sugar addiction. But so that's what I remember from it.
Fair enough.
It was such a bizarre way of filming because we filmed it in the middle of the night. We filmed it at because Tom had to go out, and we did it like a live play. So we were phoning him constantly. So Olivia or Ruth would go in and do their bit, and they'd sort of sneak off quietly, and then we'd go in, and so we were ringing him immediately. But because Tom had to drive around so much, we obviously needed there to be no traffic.
Right.
So we had to do it in the middle of the night, over 6 nights. And those are the kind of projects that I actually really, you know, you just think, when the hell are you ever going to do this again? And if you get to do it with brilliant actors and Steve Knight, he can write a script. Pretty spectacularly. So. Maybe I was off my face on
jelly tots.
On jelly tots. And Haribo or whatever.
Yeah. Kids, don't do sugar.
Exactly. Don't do sugar. other sweet products are available as well.
Did you learn a lot about concrete then? Because your character is most concerned with concrete.
Yeah. Well, again, that was the thing I was going, I just want to know because I had to understand what I was saying. But, you know, for an audience to understand, to make concrete dun, 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 dramatic, and it is, the idea of concrete in the film is really, thank God, this is really gripping. But again, I didn't want to know too much about it because then you forget what the audience really needs to know.
Yeah.
And particularly when you're only using your voice, you can't demonstrate it in any other way. And that's what the great achievement of the film is, that you've got this great plot, even though you're only in one location. It's really, really extraordinary.
It's pretty good going.
Yeah.
Finally, because I think we're over time and I know you have to have your lunch. You were in Saving Private Ryan.
I was.
What is the guide for people looking to spot you on the beach?
I am the guy, I don't know, if you remember the beach scene? Mm-hmm. I'm the guy in green with the dirt on his face.
Green with dirt on his face? Yeah. Well, that should be
you can't
missing.
Miss me. Yeah, that's me.
Excellent. All right, well, we'll get everyone looking out for that.
Yeah.
Thank
you can't miss
much.
Me. Thanks, Emil.
Okay, time for the lovely movie news. What have you got? What have we got?
Well, I went this week to see about 20 minutes of Edge of Tomorrow. Which is the new Doug Liman film starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. And I just thought I'd tell you about that. That was really, really good looking. I think people have a tendency not always to be excited about Tom Cruise these days, which I think is a shame because I think he's brilliant.
Get excited about
personally.
Tom Cruise.
I'm
yeah,
very
get excited.
Get excited. Right
and,
excited.
And actually,
I'm jumping on my chair.
And actually, even if you're not a Tom Cruise fan, as Doug Liman pointed out, this film sees him get killed like 200 times.
Mm.
So, you know, there'll be something literally for everyone. If you're a fan, he's in it throughout. If you're not a fan, he gets killed a lot. Let me explain.
Did he actually say that?
Yes, he actually did.
Wow.
Yes. So basically, the idea is it's a kind of a Groundhog Day sci-fi war movie. Aliens have attacked Earth.
Ooh.
Tom Cruise's character is a kind of an army PR man who, after a considerable screw-up, finds himself transferred to the front lines and thrown into a massive beach assault. Interestingly, it's a beach assault based in England and going to the French coast, so there's real echoes of World War II there. They are trying to kind of fight back against the aliens, obviously. But this one particular slightly weird alien comes into contact with Cruise, and then he finds that every time he dies, he wakes up again before the attack and starts reliving the same day.
Yeah, he's got the time loop.
He's caught,
yeah.
Sort of, yes. So he can now kind of, he knows what's coming. He can try and react to circumstances that he now knows are going to happen. And he finds Emily Blunt's character, Rita Verkatsky, who kind of knows what he's going through and explains some of the rules of what's happening to him and helps him try and fight back. It's going to be pretty darn cool, I think. It looks fantastic. The action's pretty cool. But also, you know, it has some really nice character beats. She's very, very good. And again, you know, Tom Cruise gets to play a complete coward, which is something new and different for him.
Yeah, Doug Liman said that the amount of times Tom Cruise squeals in this movie is unexpected.
I'm looking forward to that.
Joy. Yeah.
I think it'll be like when Johnny Depp kept fainting in Sleepy
yes.
Hollow. I imagine it being a little bit like
yes.
that.
Yeah, I was massively impressed with this. This is one of the, I guess, so far unheralded movies of the summer. And I think it's about time to start heralding it because I don't really know what I was expecting from this film, I'll be honest with you. We had seen the early shots of Cruise wearing an exoskeleton running away from an explosion because, you know, he's a cool guy and that's what cool guys do. But this is interesting. The 20 minutes we saw was a bit of a melange of different scenes.
Mm.
It all looked very, very impressive. There was an amazing... The assault on the beach is an astonishing set piece. It's
yeah.
basically Saving Private Ryan, but on a truly epic scale. With things happening, people being crushed, people being exploded, people shooting aliens, and Cruise running through it all, not knowing what the hell he's doing at first.
At first.
Then gradually he becomes a badass mofo. Yeah, it looked really, really good. The evolution of the character, we're told there's a lot more humor in the film than we saw in the reel, which basically set up all the action and all the sort of dramatic elements as Cruise is basically trying to keep Emily Blunt's character, who previously could do what he did, so she's aware of what he's able
what the
to
power
do.
Is, yeah.
Yeah. As he starts to fall for her and begins to want to keep her alive because, you know, if she dies, there ain't no going back for her anyway. So, yeah, it seems really intriguing. Could be very funny, visually brilliant. Doug Liman, obviously, you know, he's interesting. Swingers, Born Identity, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I really, really liked a lot. And then Jumper and Fairy Game on the other end of the scale. But he does do quirky and unexpected, like few big name directors. And so I'm very, very intrigued by this one.
Yeah, I would also say if you have read the book, which is, of course, called All You Need Is Kill, it's a Japanese novel.
Still prefer that title.
I do too. It doesn't mean a lot, but it's a nice title. It is. There are changes here as well as the setting and the Japanese character. There are also story changes. And I think they've changed the end quite substantially. So if you have read the book, don't worry. It's not going to be a shot-for-shot remake. If you haven't read the book, you can safely read it and without spoiling the film entirely.
Intriguing. It wasn't the only preview of footage that Warner Brothers brought to us last week. Last Friday, just as the podcast went up, they previewed 5 new scenes from Godzilla, which is obviously our cover movie this month, with Gareth Edwards, the director, in attendance for a Q&A. Very, very fun, very relaxed Q&A as well. And I have to say, set aside the fact that it's on the cover this month, I have to say I was absolutely blown away. The 5 scenes, I can't go into huge detail, to be honest, because Gareth Edwards requested that we don't. But some of the action sequences in this look as if they have the potential to be truly, truly astonishing. I don't think I've seen a director handle scale in this way. The contrast of truly enormous, ginormous beasts and little tiny humans this well before. It's mind-blowing. And there's potentially some great human drama as well. The first 2 scenes were about Bryan Cranston, and there wasn't a scaly monster in sight. And then there was an attack on Hawaii sequence, which was just astonishing. A really, really tense moment on a bridge, and then a longer version of the descent into San Francisco that we've seen in the trailers. That's not a spoiler, to show that there are soldiers descending into San Francisco. And we got our very first look at Godzilla in action, a full shot of Godzilla moving and roaring, and it kicks the Emmerich film in its entirety into the middle of next week. And I'm really, really, really excited about this, more so than I was going into it, which I guess is the point of these things.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Check out our trailer write-down with Gareth Edwards himself. It's a 10-minute thing, so set apart a little bit of your lunch break. So
10 minutes, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But a little bit of the whole of your lunch break to enjoy it, because not only, obviously, does it reveal certain things you may not already know, but it allows you to slowly assess what you're looking at.
Yes. And, of course, the new issue is still on sale, so do check it out. It's on the iPad. It's on newsstands. Do check it out. It's Godzilla on the cover and loads of other good stuff inside. Anything else?
News story-wise, just a couple of things. The rumour mill is spitting out a couple of new things, including a possible new Matrix trilogy on its way. Nothing confirmed, it's just being talked about. So consider that. These rumours have, of course, arisen before and nothing came of them. But there you go, now you know. Also, the Birds remake is still ongoing. It's not necessarily a remake of Hitchcock's film. It's more a re-adaptation of the original novella. So that is happening. Okay. I just wanted these people who listen to us to be aware of such things.
And who wrote that original? Was it Daphne du Maurier who wrote the original?
That's correct. Obviously set in England, whereas the film was not.
So with mostly pigeons.
Correct. Mostly pigeons.
And a robin.
Yeah. There was Robin Redbreast taking people's eyes out.
This could be my mum's favourite film, after 12 Years a Slave, obviously. I have some hot Bond 24 news.
Wow.
Our man, it goes by the name of Incredible Suit,
Mr. Bond,
went undercover to interview John Logan, the screenwriter of Bond 24, sole screenwriter. This
he went
no Purvis and Wade.
He went in the disguise of a writer for Empire.
Yes.
Really taken it by surprise there.
Yep. That's totally Bond blindsided him with a gadget, a gizmo, known as a dictaphone, and took down the things that he said. Five facts. One, he's very nearly finished his first draft of Bond 24.
Wow.
Two, it's going to be bigger, better than ever before.
See,
they always say that, though, don't they?
Yeah, you so rarely
they
hear
always
them
say
that.
It's
going to
be
smaller and a bit
down
worse
in scale. Yeah. We are reducing the scale of this film. We're going to make it much less visual.
To be honest with you, Empire, I'm really struggling with it. I don't know what I'm doing. Can you take a look and see what you think?
Who knows?
Do you think I should have James Bond in this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, all right.
That's the fact 3. Have you read my list? Bond is back in this film. What he basically says is that, like Skyfall, it's going to be full of little kind of probably going to be full of little riffs and little references back to Bond heritage. So that if you like the Aston Martin reveal, that kind of stuff from Skyfall, there'll be plenty in it for you. That felt a little bit like a celebration of Bond 50, the anniversary. But he's saying, I think that that's going to be an ongoing thing. He also reiterated some of the things that have been mentioned before, which is that it will continue some of the threads that played out in in Casino Royale and even before Casino Royale, although he wouldn't talk about Quantum, whether Quantum would be coming back, obviously wouldn't mention Blofeld, whether Blofeld would be the villain. So, you know, I think it was about as much information as you're going to get out of a screenwriter who's perhaps a few pages from finishing his first draft. Full story, the full interview is up on the website, so go to that for more. He also confirmed that October is going to be the likely start date. The film's out in October 2015, so they'll be getting cracking on the shoot in October this year.
I really like the references, as far as they went in Skyfall, to previous Bond films. That I liked because it was the 50th anniversary and because it was a general re-celebration of what it was to love Bond growing up and being a human British being, I guess. I don't really want any more. I feel like that was that, and now we move on. That doesn't encourage me. The rest of the stuff, bigger, better, bouncier, full of beans, fantastic. I don't want to have too many hello, see what we're doing here.
It depends how they do it. I don't see them. Maybe the Aston Martin reveal is about as on the nose as you're going to get in any Logan scripted Bond film for the 50th. But I think little nods and winks here and there would be fine. Maybe not a Bondilla. That might be going over the top. But, you know, we'll see what he has in mind. I mean, it could be much subtler than that. It could just be callbacks to old Fleming novels, you know, obscure kind of bits of character detail.
A pigeon.
The double-taking pigeon, as our writer Neil Alcock mentions in the story.
You just gave away a secret identity there.
I'm the worst.
Okay, that's it for movie news. Now it's time for our second interview. Wes Anderson is a brilliant, quirky, fastidious director of the likes of Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and Moonrise Kingdom. He's one of the most stylish people around, always nicely turned out. And this week he returns to the director's chair with The Grand Budapest Hotel, a 30s set all-star caper that could be the Wes Anderson-iest thing he's done yet. He came to London recently and spoke to the brothers Dissemblian, Nick and Phil. Enjoy.
Well, just let's start with the sort of provenance of The Grand Budapest Hotel. Where did the idea kind of come from?
My friend Hugo, he and I made up this story together. We had an idea maybe 8 years ago to make a story about this mutual friend of ours, or with a character inspired by our friend. And we came up with something, you know, we spent some time on it and made a story that probably would have been about a 20-minute movie. Then we couldn't figure out what happened next. And we tried, and we just couldn't. We hit a wall. It was set in the present day, and it was in England and France. And anyway, we set it aside. Then maybe 2 years ago, I had been thinking I would like to do a story that was inspired by Stefan Zweig's work, that was a European story, and that was set in the sometime in the first half of the 20th century, and had a sort of flashback structure built into it. And I just suddenly thought, I think these could go together. And I had this idea to make the guy a hotel concierge. And once it was, you know, I feel like usually a movie needs to be not just one idea, but two. And in this case, it's sort of three. And once the mixture started, then I got Hugo back and we came up with the whole story.
And is it true that as sort of research, you traveled around Europe and talked to a load of concierges?
Yes. Once the script was done, we then set off to figure out where we're going to do it and how we're going to go about this. And we went to Vienna, and we went to Budapest, and we traveled all around in the Czech Republic and a little in Poland and all over Germany. We always knew we were probably going to shoot it in Germany because there are a number of reasons why there's crews and there's quite a lot of money that comes back from whatever it is, tax incentive, something or another. But but going to the other place, I mean, Budapest is also a place where people do a lot of movie work. And this traveling around, we got some quite big ideas that became a part of the movie, some things that weren't in the script that are in the movie, such as in the script, there was the hotel in the 30s when it was at its height and it was at its most popular and kind of glamorous. And there was a later part of the story. There was another part of the story where it's in the late 60s and the hotel is faded and kind of falling apart. We, in our travels, decided that that would be communist and that would be reflected in the architecture. And we saw lots and lots of things where, you really can feel these ideologies and regimes in the buildings, And that came from wandering around. And also, we found lots of people that we put in the movie.
Concierges are like, they're like sages or grandmothers. They just sort of know everything, don't they? What's the most kind of curious piece of information or tidbit that you picked up in your travels?
Well, you know, one thing that was interesting was when we were in Prague at one point, the American ambassador, the ambassador from the United States to Czech Republic, his name's Norm Eisen. He hosted us for a little, he invited us over and he had arranged a little cocktail party with the members of the Golden Key, which is the guild of concierges. And so it was 14 Prague concierges gathered together in a room, and I really didn't know what was going to happen. And he said, Wes, you'll sit over here, and they'll sit here. And they circled all around me, and he said, now you'll ask them your questions. And I was like, I haven't prepared anything. And but he helped me start asking. The interesting was the general consensus is, they, you know, there are all kinds of things they do when they're part of hotels in every way. They are slightly separated from the rest of the staff of the hotel, the concierge. They're not really a part. In our movie, he's sort of the concierge slash what they call front of house manager. He really runs the place. But the concierges, usually they have their own separate thing, and they have even slight rivalry with the rest of the people in the hotel. But a huge part of their thing, especially some of the older ones in the group, is they've been replaced by Google. You know, I mean, so much of what they would normally do, they do themselves that way, and people now go to them and say, "Well, I found this one, this one, this one, and what do you think of that?" And you know, the information is no longer exclusive to them.
We have to ask about Ralph Fiennes because he's fantastic in the movie. And it occurred to me that he's played Eamon Goeth in Schindler's List, and this is more like a sort of Oscar Schindler type of character. He can do both very comfortably. Was there a particular movie that alerted you to his kind of, you know, appropriateness for the part?
Yes, well, there were two things. First, I wanted to work with him for many years just as a fan, and also because I had the sense that he's one of these actors who really throws himself into it and is intense about it.
Had you ever got close to casting him in any of your other films?
I had started to write a part. The last movie I did, Moonrise Kingdom, there was a role that is not in the film. There's a character that ended up, I just sort of weeded him out a bit, but it was for Rafe. I've never mentioned this to him, in fact, but there was a character that was sort of developing that was quite a, you know, that was a bit more of a darker character than anybody that's actually in the movie, in fact. And it didn't, at a certain point, I just felt it wasn't right for the story, but I had been thinking of him, you know, which often I'm not thinking of an actor while writing, but in that case I was. Also, I had seen him in a play, God of Carnage, that he was very funny in, and also in Bruges, he's very funny, even though he's scary. But the other thing is, I'd gotten to know him a little bit here and there, and I sort of had a sense of how he would be in this part, and I just thought, I don't think anybody else could do this. There's so much text, and it needs somebody who's a bit of a powerhouse. Yes, yeah, so luckily, he was up for it.
And when you're writing a script, in the back of your mind, do you have the question, what is Bill Murray going to play? Which part?
Yes, well, this one, you know, Bill has quite a little part in this one, but he's a kind of crucial moment. The last movie, he had a much bigger part. I think he's been in every movie I've done since the second one. I only did one movie without him. But I never made some, it's not that I have some rule about it. You know, I did one movie that Owen Wilson is not in any way. And that was just kind of, it just didn't happen.
You don't shut down production if that doesn't happen. No. How do you reach him? I mean, obviously Bill. You've got his mobile, but
Bill,
you
or Owen?
Send in the script, Bill.
Bill. You know, in fact, the thing with Bill is to send him something, I think we say now she's called executive producer, somebody who many years ago was my assistant, but even before she was my assistant, she worked for our producer at that time. Her name's Molly Cooper. Molly has worked with me in different ways and is now one of our producers. But she is also quite close to Bill. Over the years of us working together, she's become close to Bill and has helped him with various things. And Molly always knows how to get, she's actually the great person of figuring out how to get things in Bill's hands and organize things like that.
I was hoping you might have a Bill Simba signal, like Batman on a roof.
A dead drop in Central Park.
A groundhog signal goes up in the sky and yes. he comes along.
I think if you had that, you'd probably say, I've been shining this Bill signal for a week. I'm getting nothing. He's
on the golf course.
He's not looking at the sky.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, it's kind of a two-part question. One, other than films you've directed, which Bill Murray films are you particularly fond of?
You know, there are so many that I'm very fond of, but the ones that made me most interested to work with him the first time were particular ones, which were the ones where he was more, they were some of their funny parts, but they were not really comedies. And something really struck me when I first saw him in movies like that. And those are, there's one called Mad Dog and Glory. Have you ever seen Mad Dog and Glory? And he's just great.
De Niro.
With De Niro. It's a great movie. And Uma Thurman, John McNaughton, it's the director. And it's a Richard Price group. It's a good movie. And Bill's great in it. Ed Wood, he has a smaller part in Ed Wood, and he's just surreally great. And the other one was The Razor's Edge, which is really a full-fledged dramatic role. And I loved him in all three of those. And that's part of some mixture of seeing all those was in my mind when we first pursued him to be in Rushmore.
And I don't know if you're going to have a take on this, but this is a perennial debate on our podcast. Ghostbusters 1 or Ghostbusters 2?
Oh, like which one's better?
Yeah, I think the second one might be better, but I seem to be the only person in the world.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you're the only person in the world, but I'm not going to help you.
He is the only person in the world. We've checked.
Damn it.
Officially now. You've got Ed Norton in this movie. I wondered that presumably you cast him before Saturday Night Live skit, which I believe is called Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders, which is a very loving kind of pastiche of your style. I'm assuming you're not going to cast him in any more movies.
Well, the funny thing was, Edward wrote me a text message or an email saying, do you have an idea what would be a good title for a horror movie? And I really got the sense he's working on a movie. I felt I was being approached as a fellow artist. But none of my stuff I pitched got in there. You know, I had a variety of things. I don't really remember. They weren't particularly strong, I suppose. But, you know, I didn't even come close. I think they were saying, here's what we came up with. We're not going to do that. And the other funny thing was, he apparently asked my girlfriend if he could borrow some shoes. And so she knew about this. She was in New York, and he'd been in touch with her trying to get access to my closet.
So Ed Norton effectively wanted you to de facto executive produce the spoof of your own movies.
Yes.
I love it. Has he given you a sort of a yearning to make a horror movie?
I have thought about that before. I would like, you know, like, I'm a great fan of Polanski, and also, you know, I love The Exorcist. I love The Shining. You know, I wouldn't mind kind of, it's not exactly beyond the realm of, I think I could make it a lot scarier than that Saturday Night Live thing was. And I think that, you know, it's possible.
It'd be the best dressed horror film, I think. I spoke to you in Cannes for Midnight Kingdom, and you mentioned then that you were a bit of a fan of sci-fi as well. Which is maybe a little bit surprising.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I said I wanted to do a one on location in space. That was my plan at one point. I think, you know, I also, there's one I think of. Did you ever see this Wim Wenders movie, The State of Things?
No, I haven't seen that.
Well, it's an interesting movie, and they're in Portugal, where they're making there's a movie crew in Portugal, and they're making a science fiction movie. They're meant to be on some other planet, and then they run out of money, and so then it's about these people waiting in Portugal to try to get to see if they can continue with their project.
Right.
I kind of like the movie. I mean, you know, we can do better than this. But there is something kind of about it that has always made me think, gosh, it would be interesting to try that. Working on some, you know, desolate landscape somewhere with people wearing strange helmets and things.
The idea of, like, you know, your loving touch with production design and just general design in a futuristic, you know, opens up a whole new realm of kind of touch points for you, I guess. That must be...
Yes, yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen Metropolis?
Yes.
I mean, you know, that's one of those. I mean, yeah, we've seen those ideas evolve in all kinds of different ways. But
you can feel
something.
A tiny bit of your style even in like the Méliès trip to the moon kind of world.
Yeah, yeah, I can see what you mean. Yes. Yeah, you know, all that part of Hugo that takes us through his work is very interesting and really appealing. I would like to see Scorsese do a you know, what I'd like to see him do is a one of his history of movies documentaries, like the Italian one, and he did the American movies one. If he did one that was for children, you know, I think that could be interesting, because that's sort of what is contained in the middle of Hugo. I mean, it's all about the Méliès work, but it's but I think it could be expanded.
Yeah, it just reminded me of what George Clooney said when he got the script for Fantastic Mr. Fox. Did he not say something like, "I'm not sure who it's for, but let's do it"?
Yes.
I wondered if you now, looking back, know who that movie was for more than you did perhaps before you set off.
No, not really. I wouldn't say that.
Has anyone tried to play Whack Bat that you know of?
Yeah. Well, every now and then I meet a kid on the street who tells me about his attempt. But you know, it's very hard to play. And as I recall, that there's a sort of pyrotechnic aspect to this sport. which is really, you know, it's difficult to find the right
flammable pine cone as well.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I have a question about your aftershave ranges. L'air de Panache,
yes.
is Gustave H's signature scent.
Yes.
And it's the second, I believe, because in Darjeeling Limited.
Ah, you're right, yeah.
I'm trying to recall.
We have.
I'm trying to recall the name, and it's
Le Petit Mort.
Was it Voltaire number 6?
Voltaire number 6. Yes, that's it.
So you were basically one away from launching your own sort of range of scents.
No, you're right. You're right. In fact, in France, they produced the L'air de Panache, not for sale, but they've actually bottled a few ounces of the stuff.
Can you describe it using all of the correct olfactory terminology?
I can't, but I will tell you that the person who inspired this character that Rafe plays, Gustav H, we call him, he begins maybe not in the morning, but really he launches the day with six strong squirts of Versace.
Ooh. Stings the nostrils. It's a lot swearier than Fantastic Mr. Fox. You've replaced the cuss with actual. I wonder what your choice of swear word is for when you kind of have a bad moment.
Well, I would probably tend to go with the more traditional ones. In Mr. Fox, we use cuss because we were aiming for a PG.
Mm.
We had a lot more cussing in it in the earlier cuts. We actually reduced those a bit. There was a bit of a debate, because the guy who was the head of the studio at the time really thought it was, he didn't like it. He didn't like that aspect, just that thing, the cuss thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if he thought it was, I think he thought it was on the edge of being not PG, I guess. But I did insist. We kept most of it. I personally always liked it. I thought it was something, you know, I've heard people use it in real life, especially people who were working on that movie. They became comfortable just cussing.
So there could be an unrated cut DVD coming out at some point.
It's just more cussing.
Yeah. We need to let you go. Just a final question. You said earlier that you like to have two ideas for a film. Have you got both of them for your next one?
Well, oddly, for this next one, I have five things, five ideas, but they aren't really, you know, now I have this consciousness that all I need to do is take what I've got and start mixing them together. This one, they're not mixing. And something, I'm not sure what's going to happen. I have five ideas, none of which are enough to make a movie. And also none of which seem to have anything to do with each other and seem impossible to combine. So I'm not sure where that's going to lead.
So you need five more, and then you can make five films in a row.
And then I'll have the next 15 years lined up.
All right. Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And let's start the reviews portions of the show with The Grand Budapest Hotel, shall we?
I think Ali here probably had the best way of describing this. Imagine a film, a Wes Anderson film, starring Ralph Fiennes, set in a fictional country in the 1930s.
Yep.
And that is what this film is. That is 100% what this film is. I think it's one of those things that...
I'm imagining something pretty depressing.
No, it's not depressing. It's got a kind of an energy and a glee and a vibrancy. And it's also got...
See, that's interesting, because you say Ralph Fiennes, I don't necessarily think of energy, but I think, and glee and
he's
vibrancy.
He's very funny.
That's the thing. I've heard he's really good, yeah.
I think Ralph Fiennes is... I think he defined himself, he stretched himself in Bruges as a, you know, and proved that he had comic timing and comic chops. And I think he's gone perhaps even a stage further with this one, where he's shown all of those things. Plus, he's got a sort of vaudevillian, kind of almost Cary Grant-y charisma as well. He's a brilliant character, because at times he's so unlikable, a little bit like George Clooney's Mr. Fox. He's kind of capricious and flighty and unreliable, but he's so charming. And I think Ralph Fiennes is the sort of core of this. He's the heart of the movie, and giving this character, making him likable.
Who is he?
He plays a character called Gustav, who is the concierge of the Grand Budapest Hotel, which, as I say, is in the mountains, perched on a sort of eyrie in.
It's basically like the Grand Hotel Poop, which is where they shot Casino Royale, that kind of thing.
Exactly, good reference. And the story is basically that he comes into, he has a kind of an eye for the older lady, should we say, and one of them, played by Tilda Swinton, dies and bequeaths him this portrait, this incredibly expensive portrait called Boy with Apple. And this Artie MacGuffin basically gets him in deep with some bad characters, specifically Adrian Brody and Willem Dafoe, returning for his most evil Wes Anderson collaboration yet, as a brilliantly kind of, he probably is sort of the most evil, the darkest character in any Wes Anderson film, I would say. He makes Rat from Fantastic Mr. Fox look like, you know, Ratatouille. He's very, very nasty. And this film, you know, it gets quite violent at times. There's chases, there's capering, but there's also quite some dark moments.
Mm. There's a German invasion, essentially, in the middle of it.
There
as well.
Is, because let's not forget, this fictional country, 1932, is basically run by a kind of adenoid Henkel-type dictatorship. So there's lots of the kind of... Wes Anderson's created this fascist iconography, which is slightly absurd, but also a little bit like The Great Dictator or Duck Soup, the Marx Brothers film. So, again, all the things you'd expect of Wes Anderson, the beautiful production design, tracking shots and...
Everybody in the middle of the frame.
Everybody in the middle of the frame.
More model
Bill
work.
Murray.
Owen Wilson, very briefly.
Jason Schwartzman, very briefly. Model work. Fun. Light of tone. I think I liked it probably more than you. Is that fair?
That is fair. I feel like I like Wes Anderson. I love The Royal Tenenbaums. I like lots of his other films. This is essentially all Wes Anderson films ever thrown in a cauldron and boiled down to the very essence. I mean, this is the most concentrated, you know, sort of injection of Andersoniness possible, it seems to me. And that means if you dislike anything about him, it will be magnified, because the levels of whimsy here are off the scale. And for me, it just... Sometimes I think that kind of... It felt like it got in the way of things. So there's this incredibly elaborate framing devices with sort of three different levels of frame to the story that you actually care about. And it doesn't always, I think, have quite the energy it needs to have for the farcical nature of the story. I think if you're going to have a farce like this, it really has to be perfectly paced. And sometimes they kind of slow down to a slightly more languid... moments, and that kind of lost it for me a little bit.
I know
what
you mean, and I think you're right. People, if you don't like Wes Anderson, you know, this is not a movie for you, clearly. It's the most Wes Anderson-y thing ever.
Yeah.
But I quite like the. I quite like that. I mean, his interest is in the characters, and he lingers on the characters. And
is
I quite.
It though?
I think so. I think the story is always slightly subsidiary to the fact that he finds delight in the humans at the heart of his story.
But I don't. I mean, this is what I've been kind of feeling about it. I don't always feel that his characters are characters. I feel like they're just mannerisms sometimes, and I'm kind of willing to go with it a lot of the time because I find them amusing, and I think it all looks incredible, but. To call them characters sometimes, you know, anyone other than Ralph Fiennes here, to call them a character seems a little bit overgenerous maybe. But I mean, which is not, I'm possibly damning it a little more than I mean to. I just feel like there's room for improvement here.
One of the things that he does, he has these kind of surrogate family units develop amongst his character groups. And they always, for me, they always give it a little something, you know, something more than that. It elevates it above caricature. And here you've got Mustafa, played by Tony Revolori, and the little kid who's basically, you know, he has a surrogate dad in Gustav, and Gustav finds his character kind of finds in himself to give this kid, you know, some guidance professionally and as a kind of a mentor. Yeah. So that kind of that bond does kind of carry the film on that level for me at least.
I would agree that relationship is quite sweet. But for example, him Zero, the young Rivalry, and his girlfriend isn't developed at all. It's just one of those Wes Anderson-y, look, a quiet girl stares at a boy and then they fall in love things. But anyway, I mean, we gave it 4 stars, and you know, it's hard to argue with that on many levels. Just I have a few niggling suspicions about it.
It seems like every man and his dog is in this film. The poster is just kind of a pigeonhole upon pigeonhole of more people. Does Iggy pop up at any point?
No. He's Shame. The one person that isn't in this, and the dog's not in it either, actually, weirdly.
Oh, fuck.
But you're right, everyone else is. And I like that about it. A lot of people just kind of turn up for literally one shot and disappear again because they're pals, and it's fun to do that, I suppose.
Good to see Rafe redefine himself.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. Except it's Ralph Fiennes, we honour that.
John Travolta does, yeah.
Yeah. The wickedly talented Ralph Fiennes. That's 4 stars for the Grand Budapest Hotel. Also out this week is 300, Rise of an Empire, which isn't a documentary about a movie magazine with its 300th issue coming up, but it's a sequel-prequel paralleloquel to 300. No Jerry Butler and jumps for obvious reasons this time around. I am dead!
So Sullivan Stapleton and Jack O'Connell are sucking in their stomachs. Spartan warriors seizing their glory while Eva Green's on hand to give it full glower as their nemesis. Thoughts on this one? Was anyone tempted to seize her glory while watching 300 Rise of an Empire? Anyone?
No, there's a time and a place, and really the cinema isn't it. This is an immensely complicated setup in that some of it takes place prior to 300, explains how Xerxes became a 9-foot-tall golden bloke. So you get a little bit of backstory there from Rodrigo Santoro. You also get the sort of parallel story to 300, which is Athenian leader Themistocles, played by Sullivan Stapleton, trying to rally the Greek city-states together to meet the Persian advance. And then the sort of parallel/sequel bit, which involves the Battle of Salamis, which is where the Greeks took on the Persian navy. So the Greek ships took on the Persian navy, and most of this is naval battles. So that's where Eva Green comes in, because she is Xerxes' naval commander, Artemisia, and she is seriously formidable, obviously psycho, because I think Eva Green at this point specializes really in really, really scary, slightly psychotic, possibly witchy women. And she's, you know, she's given it the whole heave-ho in this case, in some fabulous uniforms and some extremely scary behaviour, which involves quite a lot of beheading and or drowning of her subordinates when they fail to live up to her expectations.
Blimey.
Some really, I mean, odd stylistic choices here. They've, you know, and Noam Moreau, who directs this one, Zack Snyder produces, he's kept the speed ramping. He's kept the sort of CG slow-mo blood splatters. But he uses them so much that it's incredibly distracting. And also just, he slows it down so much and for such long periods of time that it almost feels like he's trying to go for some kind of art house feeling at times, which is bizarre. But also just little details like the thick, almost black blood will splatter, but then it won't stay on people's shields when it lands. And just really odd things like that just don't quite ring true. I feel like it could have done with another pass in that department. And then the battles are quite good, but display a real, you know, contempt at times for the laws of physics and nature, with literally, you know, boats almost coming over a sea hill and down the slope to meet the other boats, and I get the sort of the effect that they were going for, but it does look a fraction ridiculous in 3D. I think the problem here is that they've written Themistocles as quite a straight ahead, clear cut, uncomplicated hero type. The historical record, I think, is a little bit more complicated than that to begin with, but also it doesn't make for a very good matchup with Eva Green's completely mental Artemisia. And I think if they'd made him a bit sort of edgier and a bit more unhinged almost, then you might have had a better kind of hatred or slash love-hate relationship at the heart of the film that might have carried you through. But as it is, it's a bit of a disappointment for me. Not bad, but just not all it could have been.
What about the abting?
The abs are all present and correct.
Are they as impressive as the first movie?
They're a bit bulkier, actually. I think they've done a different training regime this time. Last time, with the exception of Jared Butler, who wanted to have some bulk, they all went for a very lean, stripped back look. And here they are, actually. They do look like bodybuilders for the most part.
Interesting.
So for me, it sounds like this is... I thought this was going to be bad. I thought this was... This isn't a cash grab because it's been 8 years since the previous film,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So this is kind of an idea that's been brewing and has kind of finally come to the fore. I feel quite encouraged by what people are saying because I thought this was going to be an absolute crash and burn. But it sounds like it's actually perfectly serviceable if you're into this sort of thing.
It's interesting. You say it's not a cash grab, but obviously, in a way it is. it's just taken a long time. And you do wonder if they've missed that cultural window. In a way, they've missed their moment for a 300 sequel to really make an impact.
It really feels that, doesn't it?
Yeah. I feel the same way slightly about Sin City as well. Sin City sequel coming up later in the year. I kind of feel that people will be going, what? What's this? What? It's a sequel to what? Oh, yeah, Fake. Do you remember that film? But anyway, 3 stars.
Yeah.
To 300 Rise of an Empire. So go and check it out. And I believe it has an incredible, demented fight love scene. Is that true?
Yes. And again, I think if Themistocles had been a more complicated character, that could actually have been a really powerful scene. As it is, it's just really bizarre.
Bizarre. Good enough for me and good enough for Mr. Eyepop. Let's tackle the stag.
So this is a very small-scale Irish film, but it's actually very charming. The first few scenes, I have to say, looked really, really cheap to me. Like the lighting was off or something was off and it didn't hang together. But once they actually hit the stag do, it gets going. So the idea is this is modern sort of middle-class Dubliners. Hugh O'Connor's character is getting married. He's kind of pushed into having a stag do. He's not that keen on the idea, but he finally compromises on, right, we'll just go for a nice weekend camping in the country, climb some mountains, get some air. It'll all be very nice. He's just planning a little group of his closest friends, but his wife insists that he brings her brother, who is known as The Machine, played by Peter MacDonald. He also co-wrote the film. And of course, The Machine has slightly bigger ideas of the plan. In the middle of this is Andrew Scott's best man character, who's trying to keep everybody kind of on track and hiding his own reservations about the whole thing. So once they get out in the countryside and once they actually sort of start, you know, with their little trip, it actually gets really good. And these characters are very, very well drawn. So if you kind of stick with it through the first 20 minutes or so, it's really likable. It's not, you know, it's not going to set the world on fire. It's not a huge, you know, either heavy drama or completely hilarious comedy. It goes for the role somewhere in between tragicomedy. But yeah, 3 stars from us.
We should point out that The Stag is released in Ireland this week. It will be released in the UK next week, but we wanted to review it now just to, you know, because...
For our
something
Irish
for the
listeners.
Homeland.
Yeah.
Something for the...
Big
yeah.
R.
Something for you there.
And is now, it worth going to Ireland for this weekend?
I'm not sure I'd make the trip expressly to see it, given that we'll be here next Friday. But, you know, it's definitely worth
Why
it.
Why not? Look. 3 stars is a recommendation to go to another country to see a film, is it? Or is it just...
No, that's 4.
That's 4 stars, okay.
Yeah, that's 4.
3 stars is a recommendation. 4 stars is go to Ireland.
Also out this week is Paranoia, a thriller with an all-star cast, Harrison Ford, Gary Oldman, Liam Hemsworth, which was one of last year's biggest flops in the States. It's finally coming to the UK on one screen in London. We gave it 2 stars, so make of that what you will. And also, I think the best films out this week are both re-releases. There's the astonishing Australian film Wake and Fright, directed by Ted Kotcheff, starring Donald Pleasence and Gary Bond, which is getting a re-release after almost 40 years, over 40 years actually. It was almost destroyed. It's a terrifying, nightmarish odyssey of one man's descent into hell in the Australian outback. It is truly mesmeric, brilliant performances. Not for everyone. There's a kangaroo cull sequence, which will not be for the faint-hearted. A real kangaroo cull sequence, but believe me, it is an astonishing film. And Phil, I'm sure you'd be delighted to know that Rome Open City is also being re-released this week.
Yes, I'm so delighted by that. Rossellini's great neorealist masterpiece, and it's got one of the probably the most defining moments in cinema. If you've seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen it, go see it and find out.
Indeed, and that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We will be joined by Imogen Poots, star of Need for Speed and A Long Way Down, which is just greedy, frankly, and Jonathan Glazer, director of Under the Skin. Also look out for a Terry Gilliam special in which we sit down with a legendary director and current Python ahead of the release of his new movie, The Zero Theorem. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Tiddly.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Ciao.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to ring Iggy Pop's doorbell. See you next week.